I'd like to spend a bit of time this evening looking at that passage that we read together in Genesis chapter 27. Twins are often a fascination, aren't they? Apart from the fact that they are not very common, twins vary. Some are identical, aren't they? They can look incredibly similar. Perhaps they have similar temperaments. Many years ago, when I was at school, there was a television program called Record Breakers. And there were some identical twins on that program, the McWhirter brothers, who not only shared their looks and temperament, they even shared a job, a life. They wrote the Guinness Book of Records. But other twins, they differ, don't they? There could be a boy and a girl. They could look very different. They could have different temperaments. And in the story that we have here in Genesis 27 this evening, we have a story about two twins. But they're very different twins. They look different. They have very different temperaments. And rather than spending a life entwined in a single project, their lives diverged. So that they went in different ways. Indeed, diverged so far that after this passage, which we read this evening, we find them at each other's throats. Jacob fleeing and escaping from Esau, fearing for his life that his twin brother had resolved to kill him. Well, we're going to spend a little while just looking at this story, and we'll look at it under three headings. And it's a fascinating, I've always found it a fascinating story, because at first sight, there seem to be so many things that are a little strange. Jacob comes across as being this devious, scheming son, and yet we know that he goes on to be the one who is the chosen one, the one through whom the line of Christ is found. Esau, on the other hand, appears to be the victim. He's the one who's been swindled out of his blessing, and yet we find that he is the one that Scripture passes judgment on subsequently. And so we look at this passage under three headings, and you've got them on the sheet there: the wronged brother, the scheming son, and the deceived father. Well, the two brothers were born to Isaac and Rebekah, and they were long yearned for children. Isaac had married at the age of 40, and it was another 20 years before they had children. They prayed earnestly to God that God would give them a child, and were told that the Lord granted Isaac's plea, not just with a child, but with twins. So, what was this brother Esau like? He was an outdoor type, we're told. If he'd been in a Lord Peter Wimsey book, he'd have been a hunting, fishing, shooting type, out and about. His name, Esau, literally means rough. And we're led to believe he was given that name because of his appearance when he was born. He was red and hairy, ruddy and hairy. And because he was hairy, he was given this name, which means rough. But it's interesting that that name, rough, comes from a Hebrew word which is linked with the idea of action, of to doing, of doing. And he was very much a man of action. And because of this, he had a particular bond with his father. That characteristic, that outdoor type, that man of action, appealed to Isaac. Not just for what he did, but more so for what he garnered in the course of his outdoor life as he roamed the countryside hunting. For we're told that Isaac loved Esau particularly because he ate of his game. They say that the way to a man's heart is through his stomach, and that was certainly true of Isaac. And so the story opens with Isaac being advanced in years, an old man. The scene is very much that he perceives that he's reaching the last days of his life. There are one or two things that he needs to do before he leaves this earth. And one of those things that Isaac sets himself to do is to bestow a blessing upon his son Esau. Now the blessing isn't just a casual thing. When we meet to eat a meal, we might often ask someone to ask a blessing upon the meal. Or when someone goes on a journey, we might pray that they would know God's blessing as they travel. But this is a far more particular and special event than a casual blessing of that nature. This was a blessing to be bestowed at a particular point in Isaac's life. He's reached the end of his earthly life. The time has come to, as it were, pass on the baton to the next generation. And it's an action which we see Jacob doing in a similar manner as he came to the end of his life. He passed particular blessings on to his own children and indeed to his grandchildren through Joseph. Second thing we see about this blessing, that it's special, is that it's a blessing given specifically before God. There's a solemnity about it. When Rebekah recounts what she's heard to Jacob, she says that her husband had said, "I want to bless you in the presence of the Lord before my death." So it's a serious, solemn ceremony. And what lay behind this was the particular relationship that the patriarchs had with their God. They recognized that they were a covenant people. God had met in a very special way with Abraham. He had promised to be his God, both to him and his children and his children's children. He'd made a promise to Abraham that he would inherit the land. He'd made a promise to Abraham that his seed would be more than could be numbered. And it was understood that this covenant relationship was passed on down to the next generation. And Isaac here is, as it were, passing on through this blessing the benefits of this particular relationship which was enjoyed by God's covenant people with God. So it wasn't as if someone's estate in this world is passed on when someone dies under the terms of the will. There's a spiritual element to this as well. So this then is what Isaac is seeking to bestow upon Esau by giving him this special, peculiar, particular blessing at this stage. And the rest of the story we read a little earlier. We know that Esau went off to find this food and perhaps having to go and get the food set the scene for the particular relationship between Esau and Isaac. Esau goes off to find the food, to hunt and to prepare the food as requested. And when he returns, it becomes apparent that a great deceit has taken place. In verse 31, Esau also made savoury food and brought it into his father and said to his father, "Let my father arise and eat of my of the son's game, that your soul may bless me." And then his father Isaac said to him, "Who are you?" What do we make of Isaac, of Esau's cry in verse 34? When Esau heard the words of his father, he cried with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me also, O my father." Here was Esau. He'd expected this particular blessing to be bestowed upon him, and he'd found it snatched from him. Is Esau really the victim? Is he the brother who had suffered a great wrong here? Well, at first it might seem that he is indeed. That blessing was stolen by Jacob. But I think we need to consider some of the verses leading up to this episode to understand that, or at least to question, whether Esau really was entitled to it. And in some ways, Esau's complaint shows the lie of the position. In verse 36, Esau said, "Is Jacob not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. Look, he took away my birthright, and now look, he has taken away my blessing." He has taken away my birthright, and he's taken away my blessing. If we wind back a couple of chapters, we find another episode of strife between the two brothers, between Esau and Jacob. In Genesis chapter 25, and verses 29 onwards, a story which you probably know well, where Jacob is cooking a pot of stew or of lentils, and Esau comes in from the field and says, feed me with some of your stew. And Jacob does a trade. He says, "Sell me your birthright as of this day." And Esau does a deal. He sells his birthright for the stew. Jacob, verse 34, Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils, and he ate and drank and arose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. The birthright was Esau's by virtue of him being the firstborn. Although they were twins, they had been born in order. Esau was the oldest. And the birthright would have given Esau privileges by being the oldest. I was talking to someone the other day who said that in Chinese culture, age is very, very important. If you have two Chinese people, they'll be very keen to establish who was born first, because that immediately sets the pecking order. It immediately sets who is the senior, the most important. Even if it's just a matter of minutes, it will establish forever the order of seniority between them. And there's an element in which this is true here, because the birthright was Esau's as of right by being the firstborn. And if we look elsewhere in Scripture, we find that the birthright brings with it honour by being the oldest. And indeed, it brings temporal benefits, because the firstborn was entitled to a double helping of things. And yet Esau, although he had this position of privilege as of right, chose to exchange it. And it's not as if he chose to exchange it for anything of any value. Esau exchanged his birthright a meal. and not a particularly appetizing sounding meal either. So Esau himself despised his position. So when Esau speaks in verse 36 and says, he, that's Jacob, took away my birthright, he speaks an untruth, because it is Esau himself who had given it away. And the birthright also was indicative of spiritual realities. The firstborn in the covenant family was of particular value. So God, when he spoke to Moses in Egypt, Moses anticipated going into Pharaoh to ask for the release of Israel, and said, what shall I say? And God said to Moses, say this, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So being the firstborn was indicative of a particular spiritual reality of the covenant relationship with their father, with God. And so when Esau despises his birthright, he not only despises his position in human terms, he not only despises the honour and privilege and prestige, if you like, of his position as the firstborn, he also despises his position as the firstborn in relation to God. Esau waved aside his precious, special relationship, covenant relationship with God, and in exchange for what? A pot of stew. And that initial spiritual declension begins to evidence elsewhere in Esau's life. So when you look at Genesis 26:34, we find Esau is 40 years old. He's a grown man. And he took wives, Judith, the wives of the Hittites. Now again, for a man who was brought up in a covenant relationship with God, that was an act of turning his back upon God. You remember when Abraham, his grandfather, was seeking a wife for his father Isaac, what did he do? Abraham sent a servant all the way from Canaan back to his home country to find a wife, Rebekah, for Isaac. Abraham was concerned that Isaac shouldn't be married off into the local populace, lest it divert him away from God. And yet here is Esau choosing wives, not just one wife, but two wives, from the local populace, from the Hittites, people who didn't love God. And again, Esau is turning his back on that covenant relationship that he'd been brought into when he was born into the family. In truth, Jacob didn't steal either the birthright or the blessing from Esau. Esau had, over many years, turned his back on these things. And it's interesting that in verse 36, when Esau realizes that the special blessing has gone, he pleads with Isaac to bless him anyway. Do you see what he says? Have you not reserved a blessing for me? It's as if Isaac has a box of blessings and he can dish them out. And maybe there's one that he can find for Esau. But you see, that's not the nature of the blessing which Isaac was bestowing. He was bestowing not a mere commodity, not a trinket. He was bestowing the special blessing the covenant blessing. And so by this stage Esau doesn't understand even the nature of the blessing that Isaac is bestowing. Esau, the action man, has become so preoccupied with the affairs of life that he's lost interest in his relationship with God. He's turned his back upon God. And so it is that in Malachi, the prophet reflects upon this and says, Jacob I have loved, but Esau I have hated. Dreadful words, but words which reflect Esau's own choices. So then, that's the wronged brother. Or perhaps he wasn't wronged quite so much. The second person, just to think about for a short while, is the scheming son, Jacob. Now, in contrast to Esau, the action man, Jacob was a much, much quieter man. We see in Genesis 25:27, he's described as Jacob was a mild man dwelling in tents. He's the sort who stayed at home, the sort who didn't go out very much. But that word mild actually speaks much more of just whether he was an outward going type. Because the root of that word mild is also used to describe Noah. In Genesis 6:9, we're told, this is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God. So when Jacob is described as being a mild man, it doesn't just tell us that he wasn't one who liked roaming the countryside hunting. He actually tells us something a little deeper than that, about his inner self, about his relationship with God. But if that's the case, what led him and his mother to enter in to this scheme of trickery with Isaac? Well, we're told back in chapter 25 that when Rebecca was expecting, that she had a very difficult pregnancy. This was the days before midwives in hospital. It was the days before scans. It was the days before pain relief. It was the days before birth plans. And maybe she was worried because she was concerned. The children struggled within her, we're told. And she was perplexed because she said, if all is well, why is it like this? Why am I like this? And she turned to the one place where she could find an answer. So she turned to God and inquired, why are the children struggling so much within me? As she was pregnant. And God gave an answer. We don't know precisely how, but we read that the Lord said to her, the Lord spoke to her. And certainly in these days, God spoke clearly to his people in a way that we wouldn't expect today. And God spoke to her and explained that her two children were indeed struggling, and that out of those two children would grow two nations. Two nations are in your womb, two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. She was told that before either child was born. And we know that Esau was born first And so Rebekah would have known that Esau was indeed to serve Jacob. She knew that it was Jacob's destiny to rule over his brother. She knew that it was Jacob's destiny to receive this covenant blessing from God through Isaac. Perhaps it's because of this message that she'd received from God that she's described as loving Jacob, in contrast to the way in which Isaac loved Esau. No doubt she would have been concerned for both of them as her children, but perhaps she did indeed love Jacob in a particular way because of what God had said to her. And so we're told that she overheard Isaac's plans to grant a blessing, this special blessing upon Esau. And she decides to intervene, to frustrate Isaac's intentions. So we read of it, didn't we? How she made food. How they killed the goats. They made food. They dressed Jacob in the skins of the goats, and then Jacob went in with the food. And it is a catalogue of deceit and of things that are wrong. We have here deceit with Jacob dressing up. We have blatant lies with him saying that he was Esau. Approaching blasphemy because he describes God as having brought the food to him quickly. Taking advantage of an old, dodgy, blind man, which a few chapters later in Deuteronomy is specifically highlighted as something which is to be cursed. Jacob seems to have had a few pangs of conscience. He questioned the plan as his mother set it out before him. But so certain was Rebekah that Jacob should receive the blessing that she was willing to take upon herself any curse that might come from Isaac. What do you make of all this going on, these machinations, these schemes? Well, let's be clear that the Bible at no time condones the sort of action that was undertaken by Jacob and his mother. Truth and doing right are what the Bible tells us we should do. But perhaps, having said that, we can sympathise with Rebekah. The life of faith is sometimes a struggle, isn't it? And if we look back in the chapters before this, we see time and time again, the patriarchs, Abraham in particular, struggling to live in reliance on the promises of God. God had promised Abraham that he would inherit the land of Canaan. He had promised Abraham that he would have a seed which could not be numbered. And yet, time and time again, Abraham struggled to rely upon God in that. He schemed himself to try and get himself out of difficult situations, away from perceived threats, even to have a child himself by some other means. And yet time and time again God said no to Abraham. You don't need to do that. And so perhaps we have here an example of how Rebekah knew the promise. She knew what should take place, and yet she intervened in an inappropriate way. How about us? How easy it is for us to trust in God if things are not going well? Are we tempted to take shortcuts, to take matters into our own hands? The third character we have here in this passage is Isaac himself, the deceived father. What do we make of him? Here he is in the twilight of his life. His eyes were so dim that he could not see, we're told. His faculties clearly were failing. He struggled with the fact that Jacob had Jacob's voice and yet felt like Esau. His faculties were failing. Perhaps it's easy to see him as a victim also of his wife's scheme and machinations. Like all human beings, Isaac had weaknesses. And his great weakness was his son Esau. Esau, the son whom he loved. He held Esau in a special affection. Why? Because of he ate of his game, we're told. And although we're not told for certain that Rebekah had shared that revelation with him that she had, I think it's almost certain that he did know of the prophecy that God had made that the younger would serve the older. And therefore it is inappropriate that Isaac should have chosen to pass that blessing on Esau. And I think that's reinforced too in verse 33. Because when it's apparent what has happened, when the switch, the substitution is made clear, we read, "Then Isaac trembled exceedingly." Why did he tremble exceedingly? Was he just shocked at Jacob having had the audacity to deceive him in that way? Did he tremble because he felt for Esau, that one who he loved particularly, because Esau had missed out on that blessing that he so wanted to give him? Or did he tremble for himself because he realized that he had tried to frustrate the plan of God? Did he tremble because he had been found out? I think that is quite possible because of what we see at the end of verse 33. He accounts what has happened. "Yes, Jacob came. He brought food to me. And I blessed him." And then Isaac says, "Indeed, he shall be blessed." You see, this isn't mere superstition. This isn't Isaac saying, "Well, I blessed him, and therefore he must be blessed." This is the Isaac acknowledging that this is the will of God. That Jacob will indeed be blessed because it is God who grants the blessing. If you turn right to the end of the Bible, to the book of Hebrews, we find in Hebrews 11 a list of the great men of faith. And Isaac is listed there. He's listed there as being a man of faith. And it tells us, "By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come." Isaac believed that the blessing would come to pass on Jacob. But as I say, it wouldn't be out of mere superstition. It would have been because he trusted and had faith that God would indeed bless Jacob in that way. Was Isaac then an innocent victim of the scheme of Rebekah and Jacob? Perhaps rather than being deceived by them, there's a sense in which he had deceived himself, allowing his human senses, his love of food, his love of Esau to twist and cloud his judgment. What lessons can we learn from this story? Well, I think there are three things I'd like you to take note of. The first thing is that it reminds us of God's sovereign power. Here are a collection of individuals trying to twist and create schemes to grant a blessing upon one person and another. And yet through all these machinations of Rebecca and of Isaac and of Jacob, God's will was done. God had decreed that Jacob would be served by Esau. And that is what God brought to pass. So be reminded that God is sovereign. And no matter if we make a muck of things, God will indeed work all things together for good. He can bring good to come out of even our most twisted attempts to organise our own lives. But there's a second thing I think we need to note from here, and it's particularly something that the younger folk need to take note of. Do you see what Esau's reaction was in verse 34? When he realised that the blessing had been given to Jacob, when Esau heard the words of his father, he cried with an exceeding great and bitter cry. And said to his father, "Bless me also, O my father." You can hear the appeal of despair in his voice. No, don't say I've missed out. Esau had a privileged position. He was a covenant child. He was in the community of God's people in those days, just as you are in the community of God's people in the church now. And Esau made choices, and those choices that Esau made led him away from God. And at the end, Esau was brought to a position of despair. And he said, he let out a great and bitter cry. No, don't say I've missed out. Bless me too. Bless me also. And you younger folk, you have a tremendous privilege being in the church. You have a tremendous privilege hearing about God and about Jesus. Please don't make choices which lead you away from him, so that you one day will say, "No, bless me also," when it's too late. The third thing I think we can be reminded of or learn from this passage is that in amongst all this intrigue, the passage points us to Christ. You see the picture here. Jacob comes before his father, who is blind and cannot see. But one day we will come before a father who is all-seeing and all-knowing and who can see perfectly. Jacob may have been able to deceive his father, but we will never be able to deceive our father as we come before him. Jacob went before Isaac and he received a blessing because he was covered in the skin of a goat. If we are to receive a blessing from God, it will not be because we are covered with the skin of a goat. It will be because we're covered with the righteousness of Christ. But there is a similarity, of course. Because the goat skin could only be made available because the goat was slain, because blood flowed. And we too can only come before our Father and find acceptance before him, because someone died, because blood was shed. That person, of course, was the Lord Jesus Christ. Scripture tells us, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? So as we reflect upon the squabbles between these two twins, let's let it point us to that great salvation, that indeed we may live.